but at the end of it to do a repair outside. So the latching end effector has been around, you know, since almost the beginning of the space station, and it right now is about 16 years old, so they've had some problems with it in the last couple of years, a couple of EVAs to put grease on, you know, silicon, and keep it working. There's a couple of wires, cables inside that when this thing rotates, it's able to grab a hold of something. That's the system that they use. They don't use, you know, magnets or anything. Little Velcro is a grabbing system. So, you know, each end effector, you know, what's called the hand of the arm, either side is about 300-400 pounds if you had it on Earth. And they have a spare attached to the outside of the space station. So they'll be switching this one piece out and putting another one on. And a couple of other things that they have to do. That's why there's two spacewalks involved with this. Change out cameras and things that they use to, in conjunction with the Canadian robot arm. So, that's a big spacewalk to do this type of work. And unfortunately, of course, the NASA website will be not only shut down, but the NASA video of the spacewalk will not be shown. Which I think is a shame, but that's the way it's going to be. You know, unless they stop this shutdown system, we'll probably miss two EVAs this week and next week, you know, this Tuesday and next Monday. So, but there's plenty of other space activity. For instance, the Electron rocket got off the ground. I've been talking about this for quite a few years. This fellow, Peter Beck, comes out of New Zealand. I think since around 2012, he's really been going strong building this Electron rocket. And the idea is to put not a lot of weight in space. His payloads are going to be around 400 to 500 pounds at the most, in low Earth orbit, you know, maybe 300, 400, 500 miles up. And there's a lot of activity in the small payload satellite department, like CubeSats and satellites that are going to be looking at both ships and planes communicating around the globe. Hundreds and hundreds of these satellites would have to be put up over the years, and there's a lot of companies competing to do this. There's Vector, that's one. You have Launcher One, which Richard Branson, Virgin Galactic Group, they're building a small launcher that can do the similar type of work. But this guy is out in front of everybody else, out of all the small launching companies. About 6 months ago, he launched the first rocket, and he built his own launch complex, and he built it in New Zealand. You know, New Zealand has two big islands, and it's the North Island that he built it on. He wanted to build it on the South Island, and they said, no way. He found a spot, a beautiful spot on the end of the North Island. He built this whole launch complex. And last May, he launched a rocket. He didn't have his ground launch control people really up to snuff, and there was an error that was detected, and they purposely destroyed the satellite after the first stage separated and the second stage was going to separate. They aborted the mission. They pushed the button and blew it up because the ground people couldn't keep track of it. Well, they fixed all that, and they upgraded the rocket. So it's nice. It's almost about a 60-foot rocket. It's a good size. It has 9 engines on it, arranged similar to Elon Musk's arrangement. You know, there's 8 rockets on the circumference and then one in the middle. These are not going to be reusable rockets. These things are going to go into the ocean. But he did launch this weekend, and he got one off the ground, and he successfully put three satellites into orbit. So with that, he's going to go to build on that, and they expect us to go into complete commercial operation very soon. He plans on launching an average of one rocket per month, which is pretty good. But in the long run, he plans on doing like about 40 a year to get up to that kind of pace. The rockets themselves are all additive manufacturing, 3D manufacturing. Still in the chamber, even the valves that operate the fuel that goes into it. Everything was inside that rocket, completely 3D made. He claims he'll be able to manufacture about one rocket per day. So, it gives you an idea. There's 10 rockets on this. There's 10 engines on the first, nine engines on the first stage and one on the second stage. So he's got 10 engines per rocket. And he's going to be cracking these out as fast as he can. The good news is he's set up in the United States. These things are being manufactured by...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Like I was saying, the good news is he's going to be manufacturing these engines, these Rutherford engines, California, or he is doing that now. So that's a plus for us. And then he ships them to New Zealand, and off it goes. So the Rutherford engines, it's a unique design. He's not using turbo pumps or, any kind of a system that all these other companies are using. He's using electric motors, DC brushless, 50 horsepower motors per engine. So each engine on his 9-engine first stage has 50 horsepower capability, being run by some gigantic set of lithium-ion batteries that are running all these engines. So the body is made of carbon, some kind of a light fiber carbon. Finally, he's succeeded in launching one of his rockets into almost a polar orbit, around 65-degree inclination. So I thought that was pretty exciting anyway for this guy to do that. A few other things, but I don't know if anybody has any questions on this before I go on. Any comments, questions? This is WS2S. Okay, very good. Dick, I know you sent me an email on a system where they want to have somebody apparently is developing a system that will have a satellite that will be able to, as it comes down lower in altitude, we'll be able to generate electricity with some kind of a tether that's going to be attached to that. I know they've tried tethers in the past, so I don't know how far this one guy that is developing this and you had sent the information on has gotten. I know he's not in orbit yet, but it's a good idea if you can generate electricity as it's going down and then take that electricity and turn it into thrust, maybe with an ion engine or something, to keep the satellite in orbit virtually forever with no fuel. So I thought that was pretty good. He said they were going to use the Lorentz effect as it drops down in the magnetic field of Earth. It's going to be able to pick up some kind of induction from that and create its own electricity. I like that, but then eventually, you know, you would need to put bigger satellites. The only way that I can see that they can do that is something called the Bessemer engine. The variable specific impulse magnetoplasmic rocket developed by an ex-astronaut. He's got his company headquartered in Houston. He's working on this Bessemer engine, which will eventually produce quite a large thrust compared to today's ion engines. It's going to be using argon as a gas, and he needs a lot of electricity. I was thinking you could combine this with that tether system, but I don't think you're going to get enough electricity from that. You're going to need like thousands of, you know, like kilowatts of energy to run these Bessemer engines. The only way he's going to get that is with solar panels or eventually some kind of fission. But I did read that article, and I don't know much about these people that are doing it. Apparently, it's somebody out of Spain. So I don't know if you have any comments on that. K2RIWS2N.
Yeah, my impression of the article, Paul, was that there's two different ways they can use it. If they're willing to sacrifice altitude, the system can give them some electrical power. If they want to gain altitude and they've got a source of electricity, whether it be an RPG or a set of solar cells, if they can pump electricity into these very long probes coming out of the ship, they can get some electrostatic thrust out of it. And so, in theory, they can do both boosting without using a consumable. When you're using ordinary fuel to do thrusting, you're using something that you're going to run out of. So electronic propulsion, this is not ion propulsion, is my understanding. They're getting some kind of propulsion out of electrifying the probe itself by putting very high voltage into it, if I understand correctly, if you have a source of energy from solar cells or an RPG. RTG, I think, you know what I mean. Okay, Paul, K2RIW.
Yeah, the RPGs, yeah. The radioisotope thermoelectric generators, yeah, not on that, but, okay, so the probe itself would develop some kind of a field, magnetic field, and push against the existing magnetic field around Earth. That would be good. I didn't look up the name of the company. I know there's another company in Spain that's trying to develop a small reusable rocket. They're a long way from doing that. But maybe they're involved with that group. So, okay. We'll keep an eye out for them. There's so many startup companies going right now. It's incredible. There's a Vector rocket company, and they want to launch rockets out of Virginia. They're renting another launch pad in the same launch facility at Wallops Island that Orbital ATK operates out. And they want to launch there. They want to launch in Cameron, Georgia, company Vector. But I think they're about a year or two, from what I'm reading, from completing that. You know, they have launched a couple of suborbital rockets, but they haven't gone orbital yet. Where Peter Beck with Rocket Lab, I never mentioned the name before. The name of Peter Beck's company is called Rocket Lab. Rocket Labs is launching the Electron rocket. So, very good. Let me drop. Not much else. I did see a launcher over the weekend, an Atlas 411 configuration. That means it had a 4-meter diameter. It had only one solid booster attached to it, and then just the one Centaur hydrogen oxygen second stage attached to it, and they sent up a apparently it's a government infrared satellite for the military. There's quite a few of these things up there. But they launched from Cape Canaveral over the weekend. And, I believe that was Friday. So that successfully got up on a night flight. And quite a few flights coming up. One I'm looking forward to, I've talked about this many times, is the Falcon Heavy. And that should be coming up. They claim by the end of January, but it's supposed to go off by now. But I think by the end of January. That's SpaceX. They're going to launch their first Falcon Heavy. Falcon Heavy is 3 Falcon 9 first stage engines, kind of like bolted together. And then a standard second stage on top, which, you know, they all carry these Merlin engines. Each one has a Merlin D engine, including the second stage. So, you know, you have a total of 28 engines, 27 that are going to be lit up almost at the same time. It's like a millisecond in between each engine that actually goes off. And the idea of this is to be able to lift heavy payloads up. If this goes up, it will be the heaviest or the most powerful rocket to be launched since the space shuttle. You're looking at 5.1 million pounds of thrust with these 3 engines attached together, these 3 core boosters. And everything's reusable. The center core is original, just been built for this purpose. But the 2 side cores, port and starboard cores, actually have been used before. So, it's, you know, 2 of the boosters that have been launched that have come down and landed. He's done this about 6 times before, you know, reusing boosters. These 2 have previously flown before, so he's going to use them on this flight. And the amazing thing is that he's going to recover all 3 boosters. When this thing goes up, the 2 side boosters will separate from the stack, and they will come back to Cape Canaveral. They'll do a 180-degree flip using nitrogen jet engines, the nitrogen engines to turn them around, and go 180 degrees back toward Cape Canaveral. It'll light 3 of the Merlin engines out of the 9 to do that. And then when it gets closer to Florida, it will use the nitrogen jets to flip it again, and, you know, 90 degrees engine down first, and then as it's coming down through the atmosphere, each booster will reignite again with 3 of the 9 Merlin engines to slow itself down. That's the reentry phase, or the reentry burn, as they call it. And then right before it lands in right before it lands, light it up the center engine one more time. Gotta put my fan on for my radio. I run high power to get into the net. I just went down a couple of watts. You probably noticed that. So that's the story on the Falcon 9. On top, he's got a payload. The first launch of a rocket, usually they just put a heavy weight inside, and talked about this before. He actually is putting one of his cars, a Tesla car, SpaceX, Elon Musk is the owner of Tesla Motors, so he's going to take one of his cars, put it up as a payload, and this thing is eventually going to, you know, not orbit Earth, but it's going to orbit the sun. It's going to go into a heliocentric orbit. And out toward the Mars area. So, I mean, his goal is eventually to get to Mars, pointing himself in a proper direction. So if this all goes well, now this is launching from Launch Complex 39A, which Elon Musk has taken over from NASA. That's the famous launch complex that has been used for a little over half of the shuttle flights, and it's the same one that was used for most of the Apollo flights to the moon. Now Elon Musk, SpaceX, has leased this thing. After this Falcon Heavy launches, they're going to use it for, you know, other single Falcon 9 launches. And so about 4 or 5 months from now, they actually have a contract with, I think, Saudi Arabia, or one of some Arabian country office. Look, I forget which one, to put a satellite up into space for them using the same system, using the Falcon 9 Heavy. And then following that, before the end of the year, they have another Falcon Heavy launch schedule on a manifest for a military launch for our military. So that's pretty much it for now, Dick. Any comments, questions, turn back to you. K2RIW, WS2N, for the space portion of the TechNet.
I think it was 1 or 2 weeks ago, Paul, you mentioned that the Apollo 16 astronauts, which are the second ones that I monitored, Mattingly, Young, and Duke, were the three astronauts. Young, I think, is the one that passed away recently. And some of the things that he did that were significant is that he was one of the astronauts that did a spacewalk where he was wearing this backpack that had thrusters on it. You probably know the acronym for it. I know you do. And he backed away from the spacecraft that he was in orbit with or some significant distance, so he was completely floating in space with nothing to get him back but this backpack. Let me drop it. And I was thinking about how dangerous that is. If any one of those thrusters on that backpack got stuck in the open mode, it could either blast him away from the spacecraft that he has to come back to, or could send him spinning. There was a Apollo mission that got near the moon, but wasn't in lunar orbit yet, as I remember, and a thruster got stuck. And if the astronaut involved didn't recover that real fast, found out which one was stuck, turned them all off, so that hopefully it was only running because of a command error. It was being commanded to open. If it really got stuck open mechanically, boy, that could be a serious problem. But the spacecraft was starting to spin faster and faster, and they got close to the point where if you spin fast enough, you're eventually going to pass out and it's game over. And the astronaut involved got he was able to recover that particular mission. So thank goodness that didn't happen to Young. As I see it, what Young was doing was extremely dangerous because a stuck thruster could get him into a heap of trouble. I wonder if you saw it that way, Paul. WS2N, KQRIW.
Yeah, that was. But he wasn't the one on that. He was in the MMU, the Manned Maneuvering Unit. We got three different flights involved here. Like the last one you were talking about, where the thruster got stuck in the spacecraft started to spin rapidly. That was Neil Armstrong and Stafford. That was the Gemini mission. And after all of that, they had to come back early because they used up their fuel trying to correct that problem. But they did solve that problem. You have Bruce McCandless. He's the one that... it's a famous picture. It's been put on books, posters. It's been used on Nova TV, the beginning of Nova, although lately I haven't seen it. They show all the different scenes when Nova starts, and they always show one guy floating in space on an MMU, man maneuvering unit, and that's Bruce McCandless. Well, he died recently, a couple of weeks ago, and then right after him, another week or so after that, yes, John Young died. John Young is famous for, like you said, Apollo 16. He finally got to the moon. But he did things before that, and he did things after that. When it was time, after the last Mercury mission, when Cooper went up, the next mission was going to be the two-man rocket called Gemini on a Titan III rocket that they were going to be using. So when it came time to testing that out, the two people that went was Gus Grissom and John Young. So they went up on that. And Gemini 10, many flights down the road, John Young made another flight. And then he did the lunar flight, Apollo 16. And then when it was time to, another brand new rocket was developed called the Space Shuttle, and Columbia was going to be launched. And who did they get? They got John Young and Crippen, Young and Crippen. They sent two people up on the original Space Shuttle. And he went up on that, and then he went up on one other space shuttle mission after that. So he did a half a dozen flights. So he was a tremendous amount of experience. And the guy that would call, they would call every time something new was coming up. I think between him and Armstrong, they, you know, which guy was more more in demand? I don't know which. Back to you, WS.
When Armstrong on Gemini had a struck thruster and it wasted a lot of maneuvering fuel, I guess he's very lucky that it was a command to the thruster that was stuck. If the thruster itself got stuck in the open mode and is pumping out reaction control gas, other than giving it a command to go on and off and hope that it really resets itself, that could be a really serious situation. Do you remember how they analyzed what happened in that particular case? Was that thruster being falsely commanded to go on, as opposed to it really being mechanically stuck open? Over to you, Paul, CQLIW.
Yeah, you remember the Gemini spacecraft, and you know, behind them, it was about the same size, not bigger than the Gemini spacecraft. You had the service module, and service module has most of these thrusters, you know, a total of 24 all over the spacecraft, and then mostly on the service module itself. So one of those got stuck open. The reason for it, they wanted to dock the Agena spacecraft. Back then, they wanted to practice docking, you know. Nobody's really ever done this type of thing before. Well, they finally docked with it. You know, the Agena was sent up, you know, right before they launched, and they went up and they chased it, and they went to dock with it, and they finally did. But now you're using thrusters to dock with it. And after they docked, everything seemed to be fine, but they noticed they were slightly rotating. So one of the thrusters on the service module behind them apparently stuck in the open position. And they were trying, it was, you know, not too bad, but they decided, hey, you know, we better separate here. Mission Control said, separate. They thought it was one of the thrusters maybe on the Agena spacecraft that they had, you know, their target spacecraft. Let's separate from it. So they back out. The second they back out, they start turning even faster and faster. Why? Because you've lost this big, long wait. The Agena was about 30 feet, you know, long, you know, that's what they were attached to, you know, multiple ton thing with fuel in it. And when they disconnected from that, they started rotating very fast. I forget how many times per second. I think up to 4 or 5 times per second. So they threw button after button, and finally they used other thrusters. I believe they used the retro thrusters, you know, something that they would normally use for deorbiting to eventually stop the turning. And I believe they don't know, you know, whether or not that thruster shut down eventually by itself, or, you know, ran out of fuel, or what happened. The reason for it is, now the mission called off. You know, you guys are running low on fuel. You know, this was supposed to last a couple of few more days. So they told Armstrong and staff, you know, you've got to turn around and come on back. Mission's over. That's it. To do that, they have to disconnect from the service module, because right behind them is the heat shield. So the service module was never designed to come back to Earth. So they separate from that, come back with the heat shield. Therefore, the engineers never got a chance to really look at that thruster to see what the problem was there. Back to that.
But lucky for them, they were able to correct the spin that it was creating, and they were still attached to the service module. So the service module thruster was creating a spin, and that can be really, really dangerous if it's a mechanical stuckness, and that manned maneuvering unit, if it ever had a stuck thruster, getting back to the spacecraft could be very difficult. That manned maneuvering unit, when that astronaut was in completely free flight, what was his mothership, so to speak? Was that a Gemini mission or an Apollo mission, Paul? The US-2 or a space shuttle mission? Love you, Paul. K2RIW.
Yeah, that was a shuttle mission. But the first time they wanted to do it was in one of the Gemini missions. Gene Cernan was supposed to go out. He did a spacewalk. He was supposed to go out, go into the back by the service module, and attach himself to one of these backpacks. And although he was going to still be tethered to the Gemini, he was going to actually try to operate this thing. He had so much trouble with the spacewalk. He lost like 10 pounds of liquid or something. Sweating, all fogged up. Was in a mad panic. He just did not have the idea of how to do an EVA. They didn't have handrails on the outside. They never figured it was going to be this much of a problem. So that was the first time they were going to try it. Then they tried it again inside Skylab. Drop it. They put this manned maneuvering unit together, except on inside of Skylab, and they attached it to one of the guys, and they wanted to see if they could use these jets to move around, and that's how they tested that. So that's the history of it. But then you get to 1984 or 5, probably 1984 in that category, when Bruce McCandless was going to do this, and so it was out of the space shuttle. Now they used it after that, another flight or two after that, a couple of times, two or three times. And they actually used it to grab a hold of a satellite, which this one guy did. His last name began with a G. I forgot his name, but it escapes me now. I think it's Gibson. But he went out on a manned maneuvering unit and actually grabbed a hold of this spinning satellite. And this thing was big. I mean, this thing was like grabbing a hold of a garbage truck, you know. And then he grabbed a hold of it, and he fired his jets trying to stop this thing from spinning. But, you know what happens when you're on one end, and, you know, it started this precession type of spin. So they bailed out, and he came back, and they eventually found another way to secure the satellite to the shuttle. The idea was to bring it back to the shuttle, replace the part, and let it go back out in space. They eventually did. By the way, they did that with a three person EVA. First time that was ever done, three people. Now, because of all this engineering and everything that went into this, they designed what they call the SAFER. SAFER is an acronym, but SAFER is a small man maneuvering unit. And every time you see an astronaut, like this week coming up, or Tuesday and then the following Monday, when the astronauts go out, they have a big backpack on. Well, the big backpack is doing everything that it's supposed to do. Oxygen, getting rid of the carbon monoxide and all that. Radio communication. But one of the pieces that are attached to the backpack, you know, it's like attached to the height, it's a higher part of the backpack and then it comes down to the side, is this thing called a safety unit. The safety unit is basically a manned maneuvering unit with all kinds of nitrogen inside. If they get separated from the International Space Station for some reason, their tether breaks or something doesn't hold right, they would be able to fly this thing back to the back to the ISS. Back to you, Dick, WS-2.
Yeah, I for one would be scared to death to float completely free. If something goes wrong, it's game over. You'd want to be tethered all the time. But there was some flights that were untethered. Now, this SAFER unit, are you telling me that each astronaut who does a spacewalk has built in to his backpack the SAFER unit, a kind of thruster, that if something goes wrong, he can get back to the spacecraft? That does sound like a safety procedure, if and only if it itself doesn't fail. If at the wrong time your SAFER starts thrusting, and you didn't want thrusting, I think that could get you into some trouble, Paul. Over to you, K2RIW.
Yeah, that could be a problem. And it was a problem on one flight. There was a slow leak coming out of one of the SAFER units not too long ago. And they noticed the pressure was down. So one of the switches were on. The only time that ever happened, and they didn't abort. They terminated the mission. They said, "Well, you know, it's time to come back in." Abort is different. Abort means drop everything, whatever it takes to get back into the quest lab. You know, but you don't want. I guess you don't want that to come on accidentally. I guess there's some safeguards involved with that now. There's probably more. But you'd rather have it on you because, you know, chances are you might do something stupid. You might get separated from the space station. And, you know, this is your way back. And don't forget, they do always go out in teams. You know, it's a buddy system. So if somebody floats off, you got a shot at the other guy getting him back. but, you know, if it's one guy's safety, you know, fails. But, you know, you can push that, you know, what if, you keep doing that, you won't go out. By the way, they all love it. This next guy that's going out, single, his name is, he can't get out of there fast enough. I saw an interview. Can't wait. Back to you, there.
During that mission where there were three simultaneous EVAs going on, did they really have three separate frequencies to operate those backpacks so that the astronaut could talk back to the shuttle? That's question number one. And question number two, does each of the three astronauts hear all of the conversations of the other two plus the shuttle itself? Do they have enough frequencies and enough of interconnection of those channels so that everybody can hear all of the conversation? Over to you, Paul, K2RIW.
Yeah, all the, you know, when they're talking to each other and talking to, there's always somebody inside the space station. They're all on AM. You know, it's the old system like airplanes, you know. Around the airport, they say they're still on AM. This way, you know, one guy's talking, going on, and I'm, you know, I got my tether attached to this, and I'm looking at this camera, I'm going to disconnect it, and he's going on and on. The other guy's got an emergency, and he's transmitting, and, you know, if it's FM, you know, capture effect, that's, it's game over, you know, that by the time this guy unkeys, you know, your partner might be, you know, floating past you or something. To avoid that, they do run AM. So even with the three guys that they had out there, they all hear each other back there.
So they're all on the exact same frequency on AM. You got to worry about them talking on top of each other. So I think you're saying all backpacks are on the exact same frequency and AM modulated pole. Go ahead.
That's right. And I don't know the frequency, but I know they're all on AM. You know how that works, you know. You're not shutting everybody down, you know. Who knows? Maybe if there's an emergency, maybe they put a couple extra watts in there or something, you know. You know, I'm disconnected. Back you, Dick.
Yeah, the nice thing about AM is that somebody talks on top of you. Although you'll hear some heterodyne if there's any frequency error, you'll at least hear both conversations. I think that's the whole I think that's the whole philosophy with them. FAA transmitters, that you will hear both conversations if you know what you're listening for. That man maneuvering unit, using it without a tether, was there more than one mission where anybody went out without a tether and was going to go out and come back with the man maneuvering unit? Over to you, Paul.
Bruce McCandless did it, and then there's another guy, I think his name was Gibson. He did it. It might have been in third, I'd have to check, but, yeah, it's only, they both had, when they did an EVA, Bruce McCandless was out there all by himself, right? The other guy, the partner, I forget who it was at the time, he had an MMU on him too, but he wasn't going anyway. He was attached to the space shuttle. That would be in case McCandless got into trouble. So that's what happened there. Now, when they started developing the safety unit, eventually they took the units up. You know, they weren't sure how good they were going to be. And they did an EVA in the back of the cargo bay. And they remained tethered. And they would test these things out in the cargo bay, you know, floating around. So that's how they, you know... NASA approved these things before they started building them for every EVA unit. What's interesting, I don't know if the Russians have a similar system. I haven't read that they do. They have the Orlan, it's called the Orlan spacesuits. So it's a completely different setup. They have to climb in through the back of their suit and everything. It's one piece. Totally different than what we use. I don't know if they have it. And we've had Americans do spacewalks in their spacesuits. So I've yet to find out. I don't think they have a safety unit attached to the Russians. Back to you there.
The one astronaut that did go untethered, free-floating with a manned maneuvering unit, what's your guess as to how long was that free-float and what was the maximum distance he went from the mothership? Over to you, Paul.
So it was 600 feet. I bet it's 600 feet. Yeah, that's what comes back to my head. He got pretty far out there. And there were interviews with him later on. And his family, the wife, they were all, you know, in a mad panic right before he did this. And as he went floating away, he said he thought of something to say. Says that Neil Armstrong said, you know, one small step for man, one big step for mankind. He says he had some kind of a saying like that. This is you know, something to do with floating out in space, you know. I forget the exact saying, but came out with something smart and quirky and whatever it was, made the family laugh, put them at ease, he said. But he says it worked out very good. They never had a problem with this thing.
Wow. 600 feet strikes me as a long distance. And when you come back, you've got to come back to a very specific spot. If you come back and you're running low on fuel on that manned maneuvering unit, and you come back in such a place that you're going to touch the great big round nose cone of the space shuttle, where there's nothing to grab onto, no matter how you touch that nose cone, you're going to end up being pushed away from it, if you know what I mean. When you come back to the space shuttle, you've got to come back in a place where there's a handhold that you could grab onto. Any flat surface that you touch, the process of touching it, is going to create a force that pushes you away. Over you, Paul. KQRIW.
Yeah, with these nitrogen jets, though, you know, I think he did pretty good. You know, he came right back to the, into the cargo hold of the shuttle. You know, those big doors were open, so... You push the jets one way, and you go forward, and then when you let go, they automatically fly in the opposite direction. You know, it's designed like that, so it's not like, you know, oh, should I fire in the opposite direction now? You know, in other words, it's preset. In other words, I hit forward, I'm going forward, and then when I let go of it. It automatically flies in the opposite direction and stops them in place. So that was built into the system. You look at pictures, and you look at the one guy that went out and tried to grab that satellite. Actually did grab it, but he had a lot of trouble. Couldn't stop it from spinning 100%. But, you know, look at that. I mean, even that guy looks like he's about 500 feet away from the shuttle. It's hard to tell, you know, distance, but the pictures, you know, incredible. You can bring them up, MMU, you know, space shuttle, and you'll find some great pictures, and some videos as well. Actually, the WS one.
Okay, so the spacecraft they're trying to capture was spinning slowly, I presume. And it's got a large number of feet away, a couple hundred feet away, at least, to make it sound. And now you send out three astronauts. What did they do to capture it that was different than what the one guy was doing, Paul? Go ahead.
Oh, they had the robotic arm, you know. All the shuttles after, I think, STS-4 had the robotic arm. And they couldn't use that. They could use that to get rid of it. But because the thing was spinning, were having trouble. So I think they maneuvered the shuttle where it was, you know, just right in the right location. And I remember the three guys out there standing. Well, they originally tried it with two, and two guys were out there, and they were trying to grab a hold of this thing, and they still couldn't stop it from spinning. And they were attached to the space shuttle, you know, with restraints, and they still couldn't stop it. So then they went out and they did it with three. You know, this isn't written in granite. You can find it word for word. I might have, you know, some information a little off, but I'm pretty sure that's it. Running out of time to WS to win for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet.
Okay, so one astronaut is on the remote maneuvering of the Canadian arm. What were the other two astronauts doing with the minutes you got left, Paul? Go ahead.
I remember they were attaching the cargo bay, and they had an attachment point in the cargo bay looking up. And so this big cylinder would be coming down and landing in the back of the space shuttle. So the two were there, so they were trying to stop it. And I think it was all three. I don't think the third guy was... I think he got it close, and then eventually they had all three. I remember all three were down below looking up, grabbing this thing. Had like these big railing structure around on this satellite that was grabbing hold of that. And the idea was to get it into this shuttle bay, and they had to replace it. I think they attached a booster motor or something to it, and they sent it back off to space. But that's what happened. The satellite never made it to where it was supposed to go until they attached their booster motor. That was the plan. Back to you there.
Strikes me as a very dangerous maneuver. Okay, this was Space Report, number 289. segment number 1684. Sending through you all. Bye bye for now. See you next week. And see you now. Has Roy got any final comments? And we're looking forward to the different kinds of relativity next week and GPS. AC2GS, K2RIW and TechNet. You got it, Roy.
AC2GS, I always have last statements. Just everyone, keep in mind, once again, the email address, if you're so inclined, is tech@limartech.net. And unless I get a better suggestion, we may do either a one-part or a two-part a run at special and general relativity. And if we have enough time, we might answer Dick's question of whether electromagnetic waves are actually just magnetic waves. So stay tuned. Thank you all for listening.
Bye-bye, you all. See you next week. Be kind to each other.
The time is 12:04 a.m., 73, and good night from the W2VL repeater. W2VL Amateur Radio Repeater System. Net tonight at 8:30 W2VL Repeater System.
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system. Code number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system. Code number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
W2VL repeater. W2VL Amateur Radio Repeater System. at 830 WQVL repeater system. Time is 5 a.m. Net tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the W2VL repeater. W2VL Amateur Radio Repeater System. At 8:30, W2VL repeater system.
KD2SQQ, monitoring for radio check, please. Copy that there. What's the location out there?
I got KD2INX. I'm on the Southern State Parkway heading into Queens.
We got there heading into Queens. Yeah, you got John over here sitting in North New Jersey there in mobile. That's sir. Yeah, just I had this radio put away for a little bit there and is trying it out. But have yourself a great day there. Thanks for the radio check. 82 and 22, we clear. Have a great day.